American money, the state of the economy, rising or falling markets, how much we pay for gas or housing, this is the stuff of every newscast and our constant conversation. Money in America shapes our votes and in many ways the quality of our lives. But where does the whole system come from? I'm Brian Ellison. Today on Central Standard, we look at the origins of American money, especially wampum, the beads and shells used by Native Americans, and the influence of wampum and other early money on our financial system and our language and culture even to this day. Later, we look at the death penalty in Missouri. Critics are questioning the way the state is carrying out executions. Is it obtaining its lethal drugs in a way that violates the law? And really, what's the rush? With courts still considering legal issues and another execution date drawing near, will the Department of Corrections press ahead? It's all today on Central Standard, after the news. What is money, really? Of course, it's literally the paper metal that you and I carry around in our pockets, or actually these days the ones and zeros that somehow magically get transferred from computer to computer so we can buy stuff, food or houses or candy or companies. But of course, it's more than that too, isn't it? It's how we communicate what's important, what we value, and our handling of money and the form it takes reflects our values and shapes them across society's dividing lines and across generations. Good morning. Welcome to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. Today we're taking a look at money and its history, especially here in North America. And joining us is Mark Schell. He's a professor at Harvard and author of Wampum and the Origins of American Money. He joins us this morning by phone from New Brunswick, Canada. Professor Schell, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're really glad to have you. I guess I'd like to start by asking why you write this book, why you study this sort of information. You're a professor of comparative literature and of English, but you've somehow become an expert on money in America. Why that interest?
I have a longstanding interest, which relates to comparative literature, in the linkage between, economic representation and exchange, the sort of thing you were just talking about, money, and linguistic representation and exchange, the sort of thing you were just talking about, language communication and so forth. So it's only for me a hop, skip, and jump to an overall history of money, which would include wampum, from an overall history of various languages among the human groups.
This book, in spite of the title, is about much more than just wampum, but I do want to start with that. What is wampum, actually, physically? What is it?
It's a very interesting question in some ways, and has led to many debates over the last years, decades, centuries, even four centuries. But in a nutshell, as it were, no pun there on my name, Schell.
Well, I wasn't going to mention the coincidence there.
Oh, well, it's already done now.
Yeah, there you go.
In a nutshell, then, if I may revert to that, wampum are, materially speaking, shells which have been gathered one way or another and then polished and grouped together. And then given to those shells is a particular kind of value, one's economic or linguistic or political. By analogy, one might say that metal coins or copper coins likewise are material objects which have been gathered, and then value is conferred on them. The same thing, for that matter, would be true for paper money, or, if you want, the digital money to which you referred in your introduction, the ones and zeros. Those ones and zeros seem to be entirely not material, and yet we confer value on them. So one might say that wampum is, like money, both an economic token, and to the extent that we confer value on it, also a sort of linguistic token.
Mm-hmm. How exactly did it work as money? I think we can think about coins that are worth 5 cents or 10 cents or 25 cents. Obviously, the shells didn't have a denominated value, or did they? How did they work as money?
We know something, but not much, about the use of wampum. among the Native American tribes in all their different language groups and political organizations before the arrival of Europeans. We know this partly from those tribes that have writing of a sort and from oral reports and so forth. After the time that the Europeans arrived, it was discovered that there was a shortage of specie or gold and silver in the country. And so, for example, in Massachusetts, wampum was traded by Europeans as a kind of legal tender. That is to say, by law, a certain value, denomination, if you will, was assigned to certain shell configurations. In fact, many of the first gifts, perhaps the first gift to my own university, Harvard, were given not in specie, gold and silver, but in shell or in wampum.
So,
and those were a specific denomination assigned by the state. That is to say, they were legal tender, and one had to accept them in much the same way that one must accept these days nickels and dimes if one goes to a store, but one does not have to accept if one is a storekeeper pennies, because pennies in this country, at least now, are not legal tender.
The early days of Harvard, you're talking about the 17th century.
That's correct.
When, and give us a historical framework here, when and where was wampum in use? How widespread was it?
For the most part, wampum, as I've defined it, was in use by Algonquian language groups. That would include, of course, some of the groups in Kansas. One is there used to shells being used for hair pipes and that sort of thing on breastplates. But there is also wampum or wampum of a sort. These are mostly, I would say, the northeasterly parts of North America. So this would include the northern part of the province of Quebec, which is just above Maine and New Hampshire, all the way down in some ways to the states of Florida. And not only the coastal region, this would extend outwards, for example, to the Great Lakes. And I've also mentioned the plains. Wherever there was a need for trade or there was a need for treaties, treaties are very important here. Treaties not between Europeans and Native Americans, but treaties among the Native American tribes themselves. Wampum would make its appearance, sometimes in the form that people may remember seeing somewhere or other, in the form of wampum collars or wampum belts, shells that are woven together into the shape of, say, large rectangles, sometimes held up, sometimes worn by tribal chieftains and traded as a way to symbolize, as I say, a treaty.
Well, and your book contains, actually, I think, more than 100 pictures and
does.
Illustrations.
Yes, I'm so glad to see that you counted. That's great.
and they're beautiful, a lot of these beadworks, in a way that, I don't know, a bulletin board full of paper dollar bills would not be as visually impressive as the intricate patterns, the pictures, and I guess in later years even the words that were put together in these with these beads, these shells, to form
Yes, quite right.
To form pictures, yeah. Do you think that that itself added value? Was that part of what gave it value, the work that went into assembling these beads?
There's no doubt that as material objects, wampum are collected nowadays because they're beautiful or rare. The same thing can be said for old coins, which are sometimes collected, for example, into large museums, the American Numismatic Museum in New York, for example, or very often worn as jewelry or jewelry of a sort by actually most tribes now in the world wear coins, say, one way or the other. But it's hard to tell whether the coin, the gold coin that is around a man or woman's neck, is a form of beautiful jewelry or a way, as it were, of saving wealth. A kind of easy pocket. As money itself, though, it would seem to me that the aesthetic value, the beauty of the object to which you're referring, does not matter. what matters there more, at least, is the convention that it should trade as money, or it's being state-authorized in some way, so that there is a state or a tribal chieftain who says, this counts for so much, and unless you take it for so much, you will be breaking the law, and you will be punished on that account, perhaps to the extent of losing your life. That's the way it works in the United States now, and in some ways that was modeled in part on the way that wampum was used, especially in the early times when the United States was developing the institution of paper money, which is uniquely American in a large sense, and which reflects what the earlier settlers, up to and including the time of the American Revolution, learned from observing the Native Americans in their trade of something that traded not because it was beautiful, but because it was authorized as such and because people believed in it or credited it. In short, it was a credit institution, and it's that credit, not the beauty of the wampum or the coin, that allows it to circulate.
This is Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking with Mark Schell. He's Irving Babbitt Professor of Comparative Literature and Professor of English at Harvard University. And we're talking about money, specifically about wampum in early American history. And Professor Schell, one of the ways that you begin with the history but then expand into more than just history is to talk about the ways that wampum, and indeed all money, is more than just money. It does more than just buy things or convey value. One of the things you talk about is language. How is money an expression or an influence of language in American history?
One can think of this matter in the following way. Suppose one finds a lump of gold somewhere. It's extremely valuable, and one can trade it for something else in a barter sort of sense, so that it has an economic value and it might appear to be a token of sorts. But it becomes money only at the point when it's stamped, or when words or symbols that can be understood verbally appear on the surface of it. So at the moment that I take this ingot or lump of gold and stamp it, with the symbol of a political authority, it becomes coin. Mm-hmm. At the point where the inscription that one sees in the coin lies about the lump, we have something like what I would call money. What I mean here is, if one has half a pound of gold and one stamps on it, this will be 1 pound of gold. The British have a currency called the pound, right? Mm-hmm. At that point, because of the difference in value between what is said and what materially is, you have money, which is taken on credit. So money here is defined in terms of the difference between what is said and what actually is the case.
But what is said becomes the case.
In practice, although at any given point, one can, as it were, call on the bank. If everyone in the United States were to go to the banks at the same time and demand repayment for gold, if we were still on the gold standard, it would certainly break the banks. So that what is required is a kind of political authority, a gun, or a kind of political authority joined with a kind of religious belief in God we trust, such that we don't actually do that. Or one can switch to something other than the gold standard and hope it works.
You also talk a little bit about the words that are imprinted on coins and on bills that go beyond just stating the value of it, that they somehow convey something about either the political agenda at hand.
Certainly,
or
yes.
So you show a picture of a coin from Brazil that says in Latin, "In this sign you will conquer," which conveyed a certain something.
Yes, and in the United States, where, as I say, the institution of paper money widespread began and was experimented with and upon. What one sees very often on paper money, which in itself, of course, is valueless, is a picture of a Native American. No, in the 19th century, there wasn't only one bank in the United States, as there is now, issuing money. I mean, there were 3,000. So that to collect that paper money would require a museum that held literally tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands, of different papers. And when I began to look into this, what I discovered was that an inordinately large numbers of paper monies made in the United States in the 19th century, when it was illegal to make them, it was counterfeiting and punishable by death, and in the 19th century held pictures of Native Americans. And that is actually one reason why I began to wonder about what the linkage might be between the two institutions. Between the two facts, namely paper monies on the one hand and Native American tribes on the other. So yes, one can learn a great deal about a country by its monetary inscriptions, the one you cite from Brazil, or the ones one finds in the United States, In God We Trust, say, the very famous one, or in the 18th century, famously, To Counterfeit His Death. One of the more famous monetary inscriptions of that period, just before the Revolution.
You know, you mentioned all the various banks issuing banknotes in early American
history. Yes, a great deal of them, 3,000, probably more.
And not only that, you also mentioned that especially in the early colonial days, there is foreign currency which is being circulated and has legal status in the colonies, right?
There wasn't enough specie. There wasn't enough gold and silver. The British, for one reason or another, didn't have it or wouldn't send it. For that reason, the colonists were compelled, as it were, and so too was the American Republic in its first 60 years, to use foreign legal tender. Wampum, essentially, was foreign tender, non-European, which was used legally. It would be as if we now in the United States were using Brazilian coinage, and we had to. But we had not only Brazilian coinage in our country that we had to accept, but French and German and Dutch coinage. And all of this traded at set rates set at the level of Washington. And we did that because we didn't have enough metal. This ended, finally, only with the gold rush. So it went on for a very long time. It helped the colonists to learn how to use paper, and it ended, as I say, only at a period when it was felt that there was finally in the country a sufficient specie of its own. This meant that people of the United States had to read many different languages. They had to know how to weigh the coins, and they had to know how to guard against counterfeiting, because they had not only nickels, dimes, quarters, and pennies to contend with, but they had a whole panoply of currencies to contend with.
Well, and you write about Thomas Jefferson sort of insisting that not only did the United States need to be able to mint its own money, but it needed a pretty good education program so people would know what to do with it if they got it.
Yes, famously, Jefferson believed in education, one of the great presidents along with Lawrence. If this were a program about Thomas Jefferson, I would go on in that vein, certainly. Yes, Jefferson was one of those who understood, A, that in the old-fashioned sense, a state, in order to be a state, had to have a language and a currency of its own, which the United States didn't have. The United States still doesn't have a language of its own. At the same time, the people in a country such as the United States was need to be able to deal with different languages, the European ones as well as the Amerindian ones, and with the problem of different monetary conversions. He was very much aware of that, absolutely. And at the time that he went up to Quebec, He was looking not only at what might be done with the French language if Quebec had joined the Union, I mean the one in the 18th century, but he was looking also at how the currency system might likewise be integrated with that was already being used in the United States.
We're talking with Mark Schell. He's a professor at Harvard, writing most recently about early American money and wampum, and not only about the money itself, but about the impact on cultural and linguistic exchange. If you want to join the conversation, if you have questions about early American money or your own reflections on capital and cultural exchanges between Native Americans and early American colonists, give us a call at 816-235-2888. It's 816-235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Professor Schell, let me return to wampum and to sort of the significance of this Native American money. The act of buying or trading, how might that have been different in the early Native American mindset from what we think of as commerce today? Did it function just the same way, or were there different conventions and different understandings?
A good deal of trade, one might imagine, occurred between members of different tribes. And there would be an issue of how to convert what was of worth from tribe to tribe, and there would be the same issue of translation. So I think that one might want here to distinguish between trade of a domestic sort, for example, between you and me, if we were to trade different color marbles, and trade between you and I together and, say, the French, where we would need to know how to speak each other's languages, and we would need to know how to convert in a politically acceptable way American dollars and euros, or in the old days, actually, francs. The same problems would obtain, although one would have to say that among the tribes, there were many variants of what might be called gift exchange. You give me this, and I will give you that. Give and gift, of course, are related. And we find the same thing now as well among European groups. So from tribe to tribe, within the tribes, customs and conventions varied a great deal, as there are even among the tribes who were living in what we now call Kansas, many different customs involving trading methods, and many different languages, as many as five different language groups, just in the state of Kansas itself. So this is really a very complicated question, always ranging from, you know, the compulsion of buying and selling, purchase and sale, to the freedom, if you want to call it that, of free gift exchange.
Well, and I wonder that those various traditions and the ways that there may have been misunderstandings about the customs, either from tribe to tribe or between Native American groups and the early white settlers, does that account for sort of misunderstandings or historical stories like the ones we hear of the island of Manhattan being sold for, you know, a handful of beads, as the story goes? You also get into a little bit the derogatory term that that has made its way into the language in an inappropriate way, even to this day, of Indian giving, that may be part of that early misunderstanding of differences, right?
Yes. It's very hard for me to say for sure what Indian giving is or what its origin is. There have been debates about that, but it would seem that, on the one hand, you're quite correct, and that there were misunderstandings about what was given and what was taken. It's very likely that the story about the giving of Manhattan is related to that. On the other hand, one could say that the term Indian giving is, how shall I say, a kind of projection onto another group of what one hopes to be or what one fears to be true about oneself.
Hmm.
So that if one feels that one was supposed to give something to Indians but didn't, if one feels that one is an Indian giver, as it were, then one calls the Indian an Indian giver rather than live with the shame, as it were, of thinking of oneself as that.
Hmm.
So there are two possibilities here. One is the definite tendency towards misunderstanding, and the other would be the tendency among all human beings to attribute to others what they fear to be true about themselves. The case of Manhattan is interesting, isn't it? Because Manhattan Island and Long Island were the place where the shells most often prized for making wampum were gathered in the first place.
Hmm.
So that Wall Street arises pretty much in that area. If I had a name to give for this particular program, our discussion now, I would call it something like From Wampum to Wall Street, since what one has behind all of it is a kind of misunderstanding about even where the land of Wall Street came from. Those beads, by the way, were almost certainly wampum, which is, I'm sure, why you brought it up.
Mm-hmm. We're running out of time, but I do want to ask, when did wampum sort of fall out of use and why?
Oh, in some ways, an easy question, in some ways not. I suppose that in the 19th century and even in the 18th century, Europeans began to develop artificial wampum. There were wampum-making machines throughout the states like Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, and so forth, so that the market was flooded with wampum. This meant, of course, that the wampum was devalued because it no longer had the authorization either of the government of the United States, which it had when the colonies ruled, for example, for a few years in the 17th century, as I earlier stated. One has to take into account also that there were wars between the tribes and the colonies and the United States. And by the 1880s, we had what has often been called a kind of Holocaust, so that many of the tribes ceased to exist altogether. One would say that in that case it really was a series of small or large Holocausts. The Indians lost ground. But at the same time, where wampum went is it went into white Americans' own monetary institutions. The institution of paper money in the United States is, in more than a manner of speaking, money. So where did wampum go? It went into our own institutions. It is us.
Well, this is a great conversation and a really fascinating book. Mark Schell is Irving Babbitt Professor of Comparative Literature and Professor of English at Harvard. He's the author of Wampum and the Origins of American Money. I wish we could continue, but folks will have to continue to explore it on their own. Professor Schell, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, we'll turn to the current state of the death penalty in Missouri. The state's using a controversial new drug protocol for carrying out its executions. Some say it's illegal, and all at a time when some other states are backing off on putting people to death altogether. We'll try to sort out the issues when we come back, so stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR.